Hi, and welcome to Lessons I Learned in Law with me, Scott Brown, founder and managing director at Heriot Brown in-house legal recruitment. On this podcast, if you're an avid listener, which hopefully you are, you'll know that I sit down with someone from the legal profession, a top legal mind, and they break down and share their three key lessons that they've learned from their career in law. And I really hope that you leave listening to this today armed with a bit more information that helps you along your career path, that hopefully inspires you to go on and do great things in your own career in law. My guest today is Emily Baird. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Thank you for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Emily is a well-being advocate and mental health blogger. And this comes after an 18-year career in-house working in the tech and defence sectors with, among others, BAE Systems. That position and her career took her all over the world, really well travelled, which I'm really keen to hear more about that career today. But Emily's now on a mission to empower high achievers to reach their career goals without encountering or hitting burnout. Currently, she's providing corporate training to companies who want to improve their staff well-being. So amazing work. Really looking forward to hearing more about the new venture, Emily.
Thanks so much.
We'll jump straight in, if that's okay, Emily, and get on with lesson number one, if you could share that with me, please.
The first one is the importance of looking after yourself so that you can perform better. And I think, you know, as in-house counsel, we're very good at creating work for ourselves. And we, you know, we tend to go around, speak to people, and even though we've been hired to do one specific thing, we tend to find a lot of other things and a lot of other things to fix, and we see problems and we go and look for the solutions. You can create a lot of work for yourself very quickly, and then you want to do it all, so you end up working longer hours. And that has been my experience in a number of roles that I've had. The problem with that is that you're going to very quickly run into a wall where you won't be able to do it all and you're going to burn yourself out. That's been a lesson that I learned the hard way. So, right. However, when I learned to look after myself, then I completely changed the game because I became better at my job. I had more energy. I was more productive. I was more efficient. And as a result, I was actually progressing faster. It's learning how to do that shift, which was which took me a while.
Long process. When did that click in for you?
We were actually talking about my assignment in Denmark earlier. And when I went to Denmark, I ended up being sole counsel in country for a period of time because my Danish colleague was on maternity leave. And I was trying to do everything. I was working 80 hours a week. There was, you know, only a narrow difference with the UK, but I was there way before them and being there long after everyone else was gone. And I did that for about a year. And then I had a major, I went into severe depression, actually. It was worse than the burnout. And obviously, you know, like living in a different country and, you know, you're living up north where you have less sunshine. There's all of these things. So that was the stage where I had to learn how to do differently. And it was really, there was this moment where I had a chat with my boss who, you know, who I called and said, look, my GP wants me to go part-time because I, you know, I need to rest, and I need to recover. And he was like, well, you're working 80 hours, your contract's 37, so why don't you try 37, see how it goes? And that was like a huge revelation for me. I was like, I'd never tried to do 37 hours.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like, it was that moment of, you know, like the work will always be there. So why don't we work on the priorities and what needs to be done first? And then we do that within your contract hours. And then we move forward. So we worked together with my boss to achieve that, which we did. But it was very much the learning the boundary, learning to set boundaries and how to create that structure where, you know, you actually say stop to work at some point and you do stop your day so you can go and relax and recharge Because if you do that, you'll come back the next day and be more productive. When if you work 14 hours and then you only rest for not enough and you come back, your brain isn't going to have time to recuperate and recharge. And so you're going to come back and you're going to continue to work when you're tired. And that's how it goes wrong.
Yeah. Sounds like a good boss to have had that conversation as well and to have had the pushback.
Yes. It really helped me out because obviously, you know, there was 43 hours of work that were no longer being done. So as a manager, that was a problem because you had to, you know, reshuffle the work as well. But yeah.
How do you wind down and relax then outside of work?
What I created when I was at NBA in my last role was I had become really, really good at that. So the tip was to pre-pandemic, by the way, because that was when we used to work in the office 9 to 5. Then I had to re-change again. But when we were in the office all day, I would actually do a 9 to 6 was what I would really be very strict. And to make sure that I would do a 9 to 6, I would plan things before work and after work. So before work, I would have a morning routine when I'd go to the gym. It's not for everybody, but it was my thing. Gym first thing in the morning. When I'd turn up at 9, I'd have loads of energy. I feel like I'd done something for me first. So I'd feel really good. And then in the evening, I would usually have a plan. It didn't have to be a crazy plan of going out or anything, but it would have a plan that by a certain time, I would have to be doing something different so that during the day, I'd be like, I've got to get this finished because I am leaving at 6. And this is particularly a problem for single people because if your family is there waiting for you, like when I was not single, I found it much harder to do overtime because I'm like, no, I've got to go home. This isn't serious. Like my partner's waiting for me. But when I was single, there was no limit anymore. I was like, who cares if I'm home or not? So having things, having appointments, even if it's an appointment with yourself, helps you make sure that you leave.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, that's good advice. And everyone's going through different, single people with families, what have you. There's different challenges to it, right? It's, I don't know, I've got like dad guilt sometimes from not being home and fully present when I'm around my kids and feeling like my head's somewhere else because I've not discharged out of work and my head's elsewhere or I've had a bad day and it impacts on what I'm like in those bedtime or whenever. But I'm with you on the gym in the morning though. That's my time.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting what you're saying because I think one way to deal with that guilt is to create a SAS where after work, there's a moment for yourself where you let go of your day. And maybe it's 10 minutes or when we used to commute, that was a good time. The commute would be the time where you think about your day, you let it all go so that you can be more present with the people waiting for you. And if you're not commuting anymore, then you can create that way by going for a short walk or whatever, or having a moment where you say to family, look, I'm going to go and I was going to say meditate because that's my answer for everything. But
that's a good answer.
You find your one thing, so you take 10 minutes out because then you can be present again.
We'll move on to lesson two.
With lesson two, nothing to do now with well-being, but it was the learning to admit that I was wrong. To be able to unlock a conflict. And I think lots of lawyers have got that. You know, we spent years of training to be right, you know, and the law is complicated and you spend a lot of time learning, you know, what's right and what's wrong. And then you go in-house and the world is a different place where you've got to make compromises and you've got to, you know, especially if you're negotiating commercial contracts, which was my role. The right and wrong is always there. Yeah, the law is the law, right? But when it comes to contract negotiation, it's about finding what's going to be right for both parties to find a win-win. If you haven't got a win-win, your contract isn't going to work long-term. It's all about the relationship with the client. And lawyers can be very set in their ways. So I've had a lot of negotiations where I would be like, you know, this is right. And the other side would be like, no, you're wrong. And then start attacking each other's ego on who is right or wrong about the law. And you are not moved, like the negotiation is not going well from that point. And I've been in that situation so many times. And I was like, I've got to find a better way because I haven't got time to negotiate this contract for 6 months. I get very angry stakeholders at me for, for making the client angry. And I mean, I had all these problems. I'm sure of a junior in-house counsel probably would may have gone through that as well. And so everything changed when I read, you know, How to Ring Friends and Influence People from Dale Carnegie. And it was a book that saved my life. And suddenly it was all about, it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to say to be wrong, even if you're not. You know, when it was like, it really made me think, it's like, there was ever one time in your life where you were 100% sure you were right, and then you find out you were wrong. And I was like, oh yeah, that had happened. That's a painful memory. I remember that. And when you think of that, then you're suddenly like, okay, I'm a lawyer, but I'm also a human being. I can make mistakes and that's okay. So one way I started one thing I've changed, and I started changing the way I would start a conversation. When I knew there was a potential conflict coming ahead, I would say, okay, look, I could be wrong. I have been in the past, but I believe this is, you know, what we're trying to achieve, or this is what I understood the situation is. I understood this back the way. And then it gives room for the other side to say, oh, actually, yes, you are right. Because you've just admitted that you were willing to say you were wrong, it kind of lifts that wall weight. And you start, oh, actually, if she's willing to say she's wrong, it's okay for me to say I am. And it changes the game. But also what I have found is that sometimes I was wrong because I would have, you know, I would have missed some facts. Like, and it happens a lot in house. Like, you know, there's like a huge team of like 20 people working on a contract and not everyone is communicating efficiently. So sometimes you go into a negotiation being dead sure that this is what you're trying to achieve. And then you say, so I'm saying this based on this and that and that. And then they're like, well, hey, A and B are good, but C is incorrect. And then I turn around to my team and say, oh, how interesting. Well, it does change the game. And then you can reach an agreement with the other side. That's been a huge gain of time, I have to say, because then you reduce the length of the negotiation when you're willing to do that. But it's also been really good for my reputation because people no longer thought, oh, she's one of these arrogant lawyers who always think they're right and nobody else can have opinion. And then they're like, no, actually, she's okay.
Great lessons in there. I think it's like the disarming of people that you sort of spoke about and being able to. I love that book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's like so old, but it's such a classic. Yeah. There's so much. It's so applicable. it's a good sales book as well for us recruiters.
And when
in terms of that, like with working with junior people in your team, how did you try to encourage them to take the same mindset switch?
Yes. And I mean, and this was part of the job I loved the most, actually, training junior lawyers in the team, because you can really help them understand what's the difference between, you know, their ego and what's the right thing to do. They're fresh from uni. They've learned all these things. They've just gone through their training. You know, they feel like it's been a long road. And then they go and they suddenly, you know, talking to colleagues who have 15 years of experience and they're back to square one. And it's hard. It is hard. I mean, I remember for me when I realized that, how I felt. And so being able to kind of like help them through that and say, look, you know, just be, and actually that leads me straight into lesson three, which was about being humble. And it's like, just be humble. Like, yes, you know all these things and it's fantastic, but these people may not know the law as well as you do because maybe they forgot it because it's a long time ago and they're not using it every day, all of it, but they have seen it in action. and they have a lot of experience, and they know that agreeing this term, for example, doesn't actually really matter that, you know, on the long term. Do you really need that clause? Maybe it's nice to have, but actually this one you must have, and that's what you should be focusing on. And also just getting them to use that, oh, okay, look, I'm new, so this is what I think. Because they could say that there's nothing wrong with that. Like, you know, I'm beginning, or I'm not doing this for a very long time. But instead they go, no, I'm so right. And, you know, 50% of the time they're not actually.
Yeah. And there's no points. There's no points for being right. Yeah,
no,
it's a bit of a private practice mentality, I think.
Yeah.
So you've been blogging about mental health since 2017. How did that come around? What inspired you to do that?
So it started after when I came back to UK after Denmark, because, you know, in Denmark, I really went back to square one. How should I look after myself so that this doesn't happen again? And, you know, like a lot of people, when something like this happens, you know, you start with, you know, you go and see your GP and you have counseling, you have sometimes medication, and you kind of like settle in through that. But for me, and I think a lot of ambitious people might feel the same, like I felt the process of recovery was too slow. And I felt like just counseling and having a 15-minute conversation once a week and medication wasn't getting better faster, like very fast. It was like, and they were like, oh, this is a slow process, you got to take your time. And I don't like to take my time. It's not in my temperament. I don't do that. So I had issues with the traditional way of doing it. So I started to do a lot of research. I just spent hours in Waterstones, browsing, you know, on books. And about 10 years ago. I found it very hard to find the information. And I was searching online. I was, you know, going through books. And I started to create a checklist of all the things that helped me, that I was learning, that were helping me, and all the things that weren't working. And then and this is at a time, Scott, where I wasn't open at all about my mental health, because, and this is a completely different topic, but I really felt that I was going to be judged and I was going to lose my career opportunities, and that I wasn't going to be given the good projects anymore, that people weren't going to trust me. I mean, I had a huge thing in my head about the fact that I couldn't tell people about this. And so when I called my boss in Denmark, you know, this was after weeks of discussion with my GP telling me that I couldn't continue the way I was. It took a lot of convincing for me to call him. So, you know, so going from there to a blog is huge. But what happened was I was like doing a lot of research, and I started writing down everything that was working. And then I wanted to open up to friends, but it was very difficult to talk about it. So I'd written this, what became my first article, which was like, you know, five things that you should do for yourself when you have depression, and five things that you can help. If you want to help a friend who has depression, this is what you can do. And that was that for me, it was like my Bible. It was 2 years of research. and that's what I came up with. And I would very slowly start to take people who I would open up about depression and would be like, oh, I don't know what to do. Because that's the other thing. It's like, I would have friends who'd be like, I have no idea how to help you right now. I want to help you and I don't know how, which was the second part of the article. So I would be like, okay, well, this is me, basically. I would just be like, instead of having the discussion, which I found at the time very hard to have, I would just say, you know what, why don't you read this article, this thing I wrote, and then we can talk about it. And it really helped me open up those discussions. And one day, a friend of mine read it, and she's like, wow, that would be a great article for a blog. And I was like, okay, I'd be happy to share it because I think it could help other people. But I was like, what would I say? Like, I've got one thing to say, and I've said it already. And so it took like about maybe a year later, I was like, oh, actually, I'll give that a go. So, because by then I had done so much more research that I had more things to share. So it took me such a long time to do all this research that I wanted to speed it up for other people.
Yeah. And how do you think the landscape around like mental health and the workplace has changed in that time from your time in Denmark to now? Because obviously we've gone through the pandemic and working from home, and it's been spoken about, I feel, a lot more. Obviously there's still room for improvement, but what changes have you seen?
I've seen companies taking it a bit more seriously, and I felt that it opened, like, I think especially the pandemic really started to help discussions. But when I was at BAE pre-pandemic, we started to create a group to talk about mental health. And, you know, when you think of the size of the company, and, you know, it was like, it felt like there was a big gap that was really missing. And starting those discussions was fantastic. That was just before the pandemic. So obviously with the pandemic, things became... And I loved it during the pandemic. I would hear all this conversation about mental health everywhere. And I was like, finally, you know, this is good. And I'm really good. Like, you know, we've just been through, you know, mental health week awareness. I love to see that. I love to see people opening up. I think there's still plenty of work to do. But I think the fact that this is no longer a taboo, that we can talk about it. I mean, during the pandemic, I started a YouTube channel where I was interviewing people. I was interviewing alternative therapists. So people who would help relieve depression for lots of different ways. And, you know, we had like yoga teacher. We had a lot of sports people there because that's one way that I use. Meditation, all sorts of things. And it was brilliant. You know, like everyone would just come in and share their own experience with mental health. And I was like, this is such a great open forum. And I think it's changed a lot for the better. I think there's still plenty of work to do. I'm sure there are still plenty of people who felt the way I felt 10 years ago with, I will never tell anyone because otherwise there's going to be a massive red cross on my file.
But it's like taking steps forward, and I guess you're helping to have that conversation, which is great to see and hear. And some of the work you're doing with companies in your business now, tell us a bit more about that. What that looks like.
And I think so it's basically, it's all about how to not do what I did. And I found that the best tools, actually there's a lot of soft skills that have got nothing to do with mental health, but if you can become better at dealing with conflicts and dealing with stress and how to handle the difficult stakeholders at work and how to manage your time better and your workload, if you can get these things under control, you're going to have a much smoother ride and your mental health will benefit. So, I mean, what I do with one of my corporate clients, we've got six sessions. The first one is the basic of well-being, which I think people are more or less familiar with now. You know, it's all about, you know, sleep, food, exercise, gratitude, and being positive. You know, all of these things, which are kind of like, they have been shared so many times now, you know, of a traditional media, which was the basics of what was on my blog. So I'm like, I used to do two-day workshop on that, and I'm like, 1 hour, these are the basics. You want to see more, I've got a free guide that you can download on my blog and you've got it. But I think people have this stuff now. But what's more difficult is when something goes wrong, how do you deal with it? And when I was struggling, I used to feel that going to work was like going to war, which is a bit strong, but it was the tension I was holding. I was like, I'm going in and I'm going to have calls. And, you know, like on the hour, every hour, no break for the next 7 hours. I'd probably have 30 minutes lunch. And every call, I'm going to be working hard to influence people and convince them to do the right thing. And I'm going to be negotiating. And when I have 5 minutes to breathe, I'm going to draft a contract. These are not good conditions to be productive and to be good. Drafting a contract, you need space. You need quiet. So it's very much about, okay, if you know how to manage your emotions and you know how to manage that stress, you can then clear a huge chunk of wasted time, I want to say, away. And you clear that away, you have more time to work. Second, with conflict, you know, we were talking about it earlier with, you know, difficult negotiations. You're going to have the same problems with colleagues as well. So you're going to have difficult colleagues. Like, and the internal negotiations I've been through are worse than some of your colleagues are worse than the clients. Okay. And but if you can work on those relationships and learn how to work better with your colleagues and kill the conflict, you are winning a lot of time. Because, I mean, honestly, there were negotiations that were very difficult with the clients. And as a result, internally, we disagreed how to deal with it. And then we got into a conflict internally because we disagreed so badly. It looked bad. It really looked bad. And we then wasted hours trying to solve our disagreements, you know. And that's not productive. That's not good for the company. It's good for no one. And it creates a lot of stress, a lot of drama. You then spend hours talking about it. Then you go home, you take that stress with you. If you can kill that stuff, you win time, valuable time back, where you can actually do productive work. So, yeah, so that's what I'm doing. And these are basically, that's what we do with my corporate clients. It's one session on each of these themes, practical things, you know, like 5 steps method to get rid of stress. I mean, to deal with stress when it comes up.
Cool. Sounds beneficial to both the individuals and the obviously the corporates to have a more productive workforce. So
one of my clients came up to me because they were having a lot of people off sick on burnout. They were like, we got to do something for them because this is a sort of cost for the business. Like, it's not just people being more productive. It's people actually, you know, going off on sick leave. And obviously, they don't want their people to feel that badly, but equally, it's a huge impact on their business. So I think this is what, some companies need to look at is, look at your stats. You know, how many people do you have that are sick for actual mental health issues that could be linked to work? Because it's usually not just work, but it's usually linked as well. Like when you've got, if you've got a huge proportion of your people burning out, there's a problem with the way you are set up as a business.
Yeah, definitely a problem, I think, and challenge for companies. So yeah, no, that's good. That's a really good way of putting it. Well, thank you. Thanks, Emily. And I look forward to hearing more about it and checking out the blog. We'll share the link to that in the show notes as well, so people can follow and keep up with that. But it's been great talking to you.
Yes, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate the opportunity. And it was great to catch up with you as well.
And thank you for listening to Lessons I Learned in Law. For more info on all of the guests from the seasons gone by, head over to harrietbrown.com/podcast. Until then, see you next time.